Welcome back to Frontier FM, the essential fundraising podcast for people who want to do good, only better. I'm so excited to welcome Mateo Stewart, otherwise known as the Bearded Leader, a three-time international TEDx speaker, belonging practitioner, senior inclusive leadership facilitator, and qualified administrator for the Intercultural Development Inventory. For three decades, Mateo has coached, collaborated with, and advised senior leaders across industries, from global finance to nonprofits, cultivating belonging and reminding leaders that tackling unconscious bias takes conscious effort. I recently had the privilege of attending a workshop Mateo presented at the AFP Interior Mini Conference on Neurodiversity in Fund Development, and I'm honored to have him join us today. Mateo, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm so honored. Big cheers. I really appreciate this opportunity to chat with you.
Well, we're really excited to have you here on our podcast. To get started, I just wanted to talk a little bit about your journey and how did you become this advocate for inclusion and neurodiversity and your journey to where you are today.
Oh, well, it's interesting. And one that I'm not necessarily proud of. When I say proud of, in terms of how I got into inclusion, for your listeners, I'm an older, white, cisgendered male of extreme privilege, shaved head, big beard, visible tats. I look like I ride a Harley. I'm probably not what you would consider the archetype or stereotype of someone in diversity, equity, and inclusion work per se. But I've certainly been, this has been a big part of, my focus over the years, having worked in healthcare and worked in a variety of other industries where I was usually the one who'd be like, wait, this doesn't make sense. Why are we allowing for racism, and not overt, but the covert racism and sexism allowed in the medical field, whether that's in, patient care or even, in leading employees who might not be part of the dominant group who look like me. And what I found is over my career, I've always worked with leaders in terms of moving from good intentions to meaningful impact. And it was several years ago now, the Canadian Center for Diversity and Inclusion's consulting arm recruited me to come be a part of their mission in working with senior leaders across Canada, the US, the UK, and the EU on, how to bring inclusion to life, really turning that, meaningful action or moving from just awareness to actually impactful action. And the reason why, unfortunately, they were not necessarily that they were struggling, but some leaders were not necessarily as open to the message, right? Especially if you had someone who did not look like me, right? Someone who was not, cisgendered white male. And so many of my now colleagues were working with some of these senior leaders in different organizations and struggled. And guess what? I would come in, say the exact same thing, and all of a sudden, those micro invalidations or those microaggressions that were directed towards my colleagues didn't happen to me. And it broke my heart, but it said, okay, well, if that's the reality, and if I want to be part of this mission of making the world slightly better tomorrow than it is today, then you know what? I'll have to suck it up and just eat it and be like, hey, and I'll give the same messaging, no different than anyone else. But if I've had two or three more people being able to apply that knowledge, I'll go for it, right? And so that's why I say I'm not necessarily as, because it wasn't my intention necessarily to go into this work. I just, doing other work with other, senior executives and the other leaders, I kept noticing these, unfortunately, significant barriers for folks to truly thrive. And it had nothing to do with their competency, nothing to do with who they were as a person, other than parts of their identity that they could not change. And so that just always upset me, but I didn't know what to do about it. And then when that opportunity came where it was like, hey, we have this opening, we'd love for you to come, but this is why we need you here, because we were struggling to find the right messenger. And I'm like, fine, I'll be that, messenger, that reluctant messenger. I don't feel that I'm the right person to ever speak about topics on race and racism or, gender equality or even neuroinclusion, because I'm not someone who is, racialized, nor am I someone who presents as a woman, nor am I someone who I would consider or be diagnosed as a neurodivergent. However, I realized that without this, there, unfortunately, there's just, I hate to say it, but there's just not that openness to some folks that, unfortunately, who might look a bit different than me. So I've humbly taken this role, and it's been amazing because what I've certainly done is it's allowed me to learn and realize that, yes, although I'm not probably the best person to speak on these topics necessarily, I'm learning just as much as the individuals that I'm facilitating with. And for me, it's just been a blessing to be part of that journey.
It sounds like, you know, in a lot of ways, you are the perfect person to be in this role because of the approach that you take as well. And from what I see and what I hear is that you're not trying to take like the limelight or the stage. You're trying to make it more open and trying to make it more inclusive for your colleagues and create the spaces for them to be at center stage. I'm curious with the turn that we've taken geopolitically south of the border and here, we can't be naive. We are seeing changes here in Canada. It's Pride season. We're recording this in June. And we've seen across, you know, Canada, corporate sponsorships being pulled from you know, Pride events. And we're just seeing sort of a bit of a pullback from inclusion as a whole here in Canada. And I'm wondering, are you noticing that there's like from your perspective, are we seeing that we're going backwards a little from some of the forward motion that you may have previously seen? Or maybe again, I'm being naive and there has been no forward motion and it's all just coming to light.
So I definitely want to acknowledge what you're saying in that 100%. Am I seeing this? Yes. Is this a reality, the lived reality right now, especially here in the North American context? 100%, right? That the current politics that is emanating from our neighbor in the South, we're seeing that it impacts in terms of the spending towards whether it's, you know, to support Pride organizations or to support Pride employee resource groups and organizations or to support, you know, diversity, equity, inclusion efforts in organizations. However, and this is a real however, when I actually sit down with leaders, especially with leaders that, you know, I'll be honest, who are in the media as, you know, pulling back from DEI, and I actually just sit down and sit with the CEO or sit with the senior exec team or sit with the board of directors, the conversation is really interesting because it really comes back down to they still run a business. At the end of the day, they run a business and they need to focus on things like shareholder, you know, return or, you know, value. And it then comes back to the conversation around what are those critical components of operational leadership effectiveness? Can you do what you do? And this is all of us, you know, whether you're a multinational with 100,000 employees or your small mom and pop shop or your, you know, your mid-tier organization or a small cap or mid-cap organization, at the end of the day, you need to be able to operate effectively and efficiently. And can you do this with just folks that look like me? And the answer comes down to no, right? No, we need others. And there's a lot of course, data around what happens when all of a sudden you lose a good chunk of your workforce overnight, right? We've got a lot, we're in real life cases now. So now I see this actually as a glorious opportunity to reframe inclusion as just the purview of someone in HR that they do either, you know, themselves or at the side of their desk. But now what we do is we look at how we can embed the critical components of operational leadership effectiveness across the entire organization, that this becomes normalized and socialized, not just as a one-off that somebody, you know, in the Ivy Tower, it's their own sole responsibility, but it becomes every leader's core competency moving forward in terms of how they set the table for folks to truly be able to thrive, not just fit in, not mask who they are or code switch, but to truly show up as their true authentic selves. Thrive, because what the data tells us is that a high-performing, high-thriving, highly innovative team needs that in order to succeed. And if you don't have just the basis of non-discrimination or equity where folks are just treated fairly and the sense that they belong and then that they feel psychologically safe. If you don't have those three components, you're not going to be able to innovate. You're not going to be able to truly have a high performing, high thriving, highly innovative team. And so when right now, what I'm finding is, especially with these leaders, is we're changing the conversation from, okay, so maybe we're not going to just focus on, you know, diversity and diversity hires, but really what we need to do is make sure that we get the best of the best in our organizations. And when they come into our organization, there isn't some glass cliff that they're going to fall off or a glass ceiling, but that they can truly thrive. And if we have that, because we're setting the table, not for this quarter results, but you, especially if you're brought in as a, you know, a CEO or the board, you have a responsibility to ensure that organization thrives.
Right.
5-10 years from now, you're not building something. This isn't a some tech startup that you've got a Series A raise and you're just building it enough to sell. Many of these organizations are focused on longer term success rates, right? And that's what, and so when we frame it like that, they're right. And then how do we attract the next generation, right? The Gen Z, Gen Z generation, they're not going to put up with stuff that I put up with, my generation. They've made it very clear that the priority isn't money or benefits. It's the culture. It's the values alignment. And if we truly want the next generation, if we're trying to build for the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years of an organization, then we're going to have to set the table differently. And then now the conversation switches from not that we're doing something special because someone is racialized or someone is a woman or someone is part of the 2S LGBTQI plus community. We're doing it because that individual who just happens to be from the queer community or just happens to be racialized or just happens to be a woman is actually the best person for the role. And we need to attract, not only attract, but retain them and ensure that the conditions are set that they can thrive. And now what I'm finding is these organizations that have been in the media saying, hey, we got to pull back, are actually like, well, no, if we actually want longer term sustained growth, you're right. And this can't just be HR who does this. This has got to be every core competency. And so what we're seeing now is, especially over the past 6 months, what I've seen is a refocus on, right, we can't just let this be HR's purview. This has to be every single leader in our organizations, a part of their core competency. And that's what I'm seeing. So I'm seeing this trend. So as much as I hate to see all the negativity in the media and the negativity on social media, and it breaks my heart, what I am seeing behind the scenes in boardrooms across North America and in Europe as well is this refocus to go, wait a second here, we're going to lose the top talent and we can't just rely on the dominant group to carry the workload alone. They're not enough and they don't have the talent. So how do we move forward?
Love that positive aspect that you're seeing that, you know, make me feel a little bit better. And I'm sure a lot of the listeners out there feel a little bit better as well in the way things are going in terms of that continued push for creating those culturally safe and psychologically safe workforces, workplaces. And, you know, as nonprofits, we, you know, we're also businesses and we also have our employees and that sort of those similar environments and communities. And also on the same side, we're also, you know, our clients and nonprofits who are speaking to the leaders that you're also speaking to in that lens, right? We're talking to them from a different perspective, asking for money or sponsorship or what have you, but to know that these conversations are being had within their workplaces. So they're still perhaps taking that into their personal lives as well and how they approach things. I'm curious about, you know, you speak with a lot of senior executives and boards, and you know, for smaller organizations, you mentioned the mom pop kind of organizations, and for nonprofits who may not have the deep pockets as some of these larger organizations in the finance sector or healthcare even. You know, how do they create these culturally sensitive environments and safe in their workplaces to begin with?
Right.
We can talk about, you know, our donor relations and that sort of thing. But the basic area that we need to come to terms with, I think, as well, is how do we create these environments that are safe for the employees?
I love that question. And it's interesting, as someone who has his feet both in the for-profit and nonprofit area, what I've seen, and this is the same whether, you know, when I was working and leading, you know, medical teams in internal medicine and emergency rooms or at the Olympics or at nonprofit organizations, the things that the leaders do to do what you're just saying or asking actually don't change. Just maybe the how, the what, the tactics might change or the money that's spent on it. However, the things that the leader does, those critical components that the leader does for both operational and leadership effectiveness don't change. And I would say they really center around three pillars that any, whether you're a nonprofit or you're working in a for-profit or you're just, at the end of the day, let me reframe this. We're leading people. People are still doing the work, right? Whether it doesn't matter what the outcome, whether we're building widgets or, you know, what's the service that we're providing. We're leading human beings who need to do things in order for us to accomplish that goal, right? Whatever that OKR is or whatever that goal is for that organization. And so I would say it comes down to sort of three pillars as a leader. How the culture that we're building, and again, that is co-created, not necessarily always top-down. The processes that we have in place, right? And that we can constantly go back and review, even if we've done, you know, one or two tactics that might make it slightly more inclusive, there's always more that we can do. And then what tools are available, right? And when we look at the tools that are available, the processes and the culture in place, these are all things that as leaders, we can help influence and we can help ensure that those conditions are set for a high performing, high thriving team. And so I don't know if that answers your question, but I think there, you know, when I think of, because I'm right now, funny enough, we're getting into strat planning season with one of the one of the nonprofits that I sit on, and it keeps coming down to, you know, again, what is our values? What is our mission? Who are we impacting? And do the folks that are doing the work that needs to get done to achieve that vision, mission, vision, values,
right,
do they have the right culture in order to succeed? Have we set those right conditions? Do they have the right processes? Or do our policies and procedures match? Do they understand? Do they get that? And do they have the tools to do the thing, right? So I just come down to, do they have the right direction? Do they direct the competencies? What are the obstacles that might be getting in their way? Can we remove those obstacles? Help get that out of the way? And then really truly understanding what is the motivation. And that probably that motivation piece maybe slightly changes from the for-profit to nonprofit, right? Many of us in the nonprofit world, we do things not because we're trying to make a profit. So our motivation might change. However, how we activate that motivation as a leader doesn't necessarily change, right? There's things that we can do, right? And we're also seeing too, and this is my call out to any leader right now in for-profit as well, is that the what we know from the understanding from the data from the Gen Z or Gen Z generation is that what motivates them far different than my generation. And we need to better understand that values alignment is a top priority for this generation. And so how do you ensure that now you can really tap into that?
Super curious. Mm-hmm. I might be going slightly off topic here, but in terms of that values alignment, mm-hmm, and sort of the Gen Z, which I do say Gen Z, shout out to Canadian.
Love it. Yeah. You can tell I have American clients, so I never know which one to say. I get confused.
It's all good. Everyone around me, all even my kids who are, you know, Canadian, they call themselves Gen Z. I'm like, no, you're Gen Z.
Yeah.
Anyhow, I'm curious about that values alignment between the different generations, as it were. I'm a proud Gen Xer, not a boomer, not a millennial.
Xer here. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, the forgotten one, the Gen Xer. And perhaps I am mistaken in my own values. Mm-hmm. Perhaps my values are more aligned to the Gen Z because I had children later in life. So, you know, they're keeping me young.
Right.
How that is in terms of how we see that playing out in the workplace or in donor relations where, you know, if I'm looking for a job or if I'm looking to sit on a board, I'm going to look at you know, what sort of inclusive practices are there? Is it on their website? And try and find out a little bit more and not, I'm fortunate that I have that opportunity to do that, but is that not the norm for Gen X and millennials? And it's that you're seeing, and you're seeing primarily in the Gen Zs.
Well, it's interesting because, again, when I think even 20 years ago, we weren't even collecting this data, right? Or we collected it from very much a lens of what are the current processes? And that's the only question we're going to ask. And I think maybe when we take a look back at the research, I think we have started asking questions differently than we did, you know, even in the early 2000s when it came to things like employee engagement. Right. So I honestly think that this is just a personal opinion, but that we just weren't asking the right questions. Because I think when I look at what even motivates me, and I know what motivates me now has obviously changed, you know, from the 80s, 90s and today. But it's always been that, do I feel aligned? Right. And then maybe that is a Gen X thing, right? Where we want to be, you know, I remember, what was that movie, Reality Bites with, I remember that. Right. Where we're just happy that you're going to pay us every 2 weeks and it was going to be automatically deposited and we didn't have to like get a check. Right. Like that, to me, was like the most exciting thing. But at the end of the day, what we didn't talk about, because it wasn't normalized and socialized yet, was, do I really want to be here in this organization? Right. I remember I was working in healthcare and I got recruited to go work at a bank, and no shame to banks, but let's be honest here. It was a very different motivation than, you know, coming in and seeing patients or knowing that we're making an impact. And I was just like, I would go into these meetings and I'm like, I don't really care about shareholder value. I don't care. Like, that's great that you want to increase shareholder value, but, you know, that to me just wasn't why I would want to do something or put in extra effort or go the extra mile, right? Where if I knew that me not going the extra mile meant that, you know, my colleague Lisa had to work harder, then I would, but I did that for my colleague, not for the org.
Right, right. And I guess my question for, you know, my reason for bringing this up is when we're looking at our donor communications and how we interact with our donors and even our corporate sponsors, the demographic tends to skew a little older. Mm-hmm. And there seems to sometimes be this approach, oh, if we want to attract the younger donors, we need to do X. And if we want to attract our older donors, we need to be Y. And I'm curious about being, you know, more inclusive and culturally aware.
Right.
If that is just not an approach that would be beneficial, regardless of who, you know, what generation.
I might reframe it. Maybe I'm not understanding the question, because the way I'm interpreting the question is, especially when it comes to attracting and retaining donors, is meeting them where they're at.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's sort of where, and this has been my messaging to the EDs that I'm working with, is executive directors, I shouldn't use in acronyms, but how, for our donor management, where are they at right now? Right. So if our messaging is only on, you know, I'm going to say Twitter or whatever it's called, X, but that's not where they're at.
Right.
Or they're on Facebook. We're on Facebook and X. Well, they're on TikTok. They're somewhere else. Right. They have other messaging. They're using Substack. And so have we adapted to where they are and the messaging? Right. I remember we used to produce these massive, very beautiful impact books about the impact we had to attract. And that might be great for some, but maybe not for others. So how are we adapting our communication style? How are we understanding, you know, where they're at and how they like and their preferred communication style? Because it varies. And do we take an approach of, this is the way we've done it, so therefore you should just get along and do it this way? Or do we adapt differently?
Yeah, that's a good point, which also, if we're looking at cultural diversity, how do we know where they're at?
Right. Yeah. And that takes a lot more research. That takes a lot more, listening opportunities, you know, and it doesn't take a lot to do that, right? For some organizations, it could just be, especially if you're in a small community, You can just be sitting and listening in your community, right? When you get some larger organization, that becomes difficult because then now, I mean, difficult is a different challenge, but there, you're still listening. You're still spending more time. The analogy I like to use is this one. I don't know if you've mountain climbed or climbed any mountains, but I climbed years ago, climbed Mount Fuji, and I'm still on these Facebook groups for Mount Fuji. And when I climbed Mount Fuji, and even the mountains here, I always take an oxygen tank. I never actually used it myself. I've administered it, that oxygen tank, to someone who was in distress because of the altitude different. The altitude impacted them differently. But I see all the time on these Facebook groups, or even just in conversation with other people who hike and climb mountains, where they're like, oh, you know, that's not that high of an elevation. I didn't need oxygen, so that therefore you don't need to bring it as well.
Right.
And that approach I see in leadership, I see that as approach as well in donor relations and nonprofits, is that because we've had these three or four donors that have been with us for a long time, and this is the way they like it, therefore we're going to use that with everybody. Instead of realizing that, with the analogy of climbing that mountain or climbing, you know, that volcano or whatever it is, that altitude will impact an individual human being differently. And if we don't recognize that, and if we just take a sort of a one size approach fits all, we're going to fail. Because just like that one climber who might have struggled because maybe they weren't acclimatized to that altitude, or maybe that was their first time climbing, or maybe that's just the way, you know, their blood glass arterial works. So how do we accommodate or take that into account? And the same thing with our donors, is that they're going to be different. And we, now that we have, as a society, have started normalizing, socializing, talking about things like neuro differences or the diversity of neurotypes, we're going to see folks who are going to be more adamant that, no, I need to be honored. I need to be respected. Not because of my achievements or my positionality, but because of I'm a human. And right. When we take that human-based approach, I think that's when we start looking at, okay, how can we now start removing any of those barriers, whether it's a barrier for an employee or a barrier for donor accessing us, or even continuing to build a relationship with us as a nonprofit, then wow, we can truly move forward. And are we going to get it right all the time? Probably not. But if we come with that right approach of everyone's going to be different, there's diverse neurotypes, there's diverse folks, how do we set the table for them?
Right. So you've raised some really important points here around meeting people where they're at, going back to the beginning of our conversation where it was around creating those safe spaces in the workplace for the diversity that we have. And are there any quick takeaways around making sure that these spaces are more inclusive? And how are we ensuring that that is part of our culture? Are there any quick tips
you can provide? For sure, yeah. So I think one of the first things I when I sit down with the board or with the senior leadership team, I always ask them to take a quick scan, both internally at an individual level, then at a team level, then at, you know, systemic org level. And there's four sort of, I would say, buckets to take a look at. One was when we're thinking about, neuroinclusion. Thinking about it from cognitive inclusion, right? What are those ways that we can provide, you know, clear or more flexible ways to process information? And then what about physical and sensory inclusion, right? Whether creating comfortable or accessible sensory environments. And very specific example, one of the nonprofits that I worked on for a while, you know, their main source of revenue was always their gala event. And the gala event, great, 500 people, they'd pack it, it was lots of drinking, lots of different other things. But for somebody who is part of that neurodiversity or had maybe some of those more diverse neurotypes, that could be physical and sensory overload for them. So what about, how do we provide other avenues at that event or other ways in which folks can present? And then what about that emotional and social inclusion that we need to take a look at? So the other thing too that we take a look at is unlearning some assumptions. Because what I have found with almost every nonprofit that I've worked with, whether I was on the board or, you know, I worked there myself, what I found is there comes assumptions that were being made, especially around for donors, right? That donors expected a certain way in which to be interacted with, that if they actually cared about our cause, they'd actually show up. But we know that's not always true, right? That all donors process and express generosity the same way. So because Greg did it this way, therefore all of them should be that way. Or that the way that we've communicated with very complex visuals or complex storytelling is going to land for everybody. The other one too, which I really interesting, because I had an ED a few years ago, was just like, I know they give me some money, but I just don't like them. And I'm like, well, why don't you like them? Well, every time they come into the office to do their check presentation, they never once look me in the eye. So because of that, I just don't trust them. I don't think they're sincere. And we never actually engaged with them. And what we found was, is when we changed this expectation that direct eye contact or a firm handshake meant that they were interested in us or that they were trustworthy, as soon as we changed that to maybe they don't for whatever reason. And it turned out once we had a conversation, took them out, you know, for a walk, they actually loved going for a walk versus coming into the office setting because of the way the lighting was. But we also found, you know, as we just had a conversation with them and that walk, that they were, you know, self-diagnosed and then had a later in life diagnosis of being neurodiverse and being, you know, on the spectrum for autism. What they found was is that they just needed a different way to communicate. Right. They didn't care for, you know, abundance of text messages and long and lengthy emails. They didn't care for big group parties, but they really cared deeply about the cause. So we just had to find a different way to engage with them. And so when I think about what are those things that we can do, definitely look at ways that we can reduce sensory overwhelm, whether it's in events or digital overwhelm as well in the way that we communicate. You know, looking at different ways that we can tell our story. Because that's been, I remember that, what's your story was like a big push in the early 2000s with the nonprofits I was working with. And that's great. And don't get me wrong, telling your story is important. But how we tell our story, that needs to evolve. Meeting people where they're at. Another thing too, and this has nothing to do with neuroinclusion, but just inclusion in general, is oftentimes our donation forms and campaigns aren't necessarily screen reader friendly. And perfect example would be Diabetes Canada. If you're not familiar, Google Diabetes Canada. And I'm not trying to pick on them, but they created they had a graphic designer come in and create this new design for them for their logo, where the word diabetes had like a strike through it. The problem with that, however, was that individuals who had visual concerns or disabilities, you know, might have some limited vision or had no vision at all. Guess what? Their screen reader could not read any of their donor materials. And so these folks, and you can imagine folks, especially because diabetes, a lot of folks, you know, part of it, especially later in life, might go blind or might have some level of blindness. And so all of a sudden now you're alienating a huge portion of folks that want to donate, but they couldn't even navigate the donation form or all the material that was being sent to them because they hadn't taken into account that could a screen reader, some assistive device, or assistive technology help them access the materials that were critical for them to be able to send you money. And so that was a huge miss, right? And I know they're still working on it, but and bless the people from Diabetes Canada, my big hugs. But I just share that as a specific example where, you know, great intention, but what wasn't taken into account was, again, that donor relation. And again, it's not just the donors, right? What about employees that might work for that organization? How could they necessarily access it? And what ended up happening was if they had a screen reader and the first thing that the screen reader is trying to read was that logo, the screen reader, that technology would just stop and not read any further because it hit an error, right? And I didn't know what to do afterwards. And so the other thing too, if I'm getting really specific, is I'm not talking about any nonprofit in particular, but as an industry as a whole, we've tended to have very much narrow definitions of engagement with our donors. And we need to expand that. And as well, expand the ways in which we can create a feedback-rich, feedback-safe environment. So it's not just based on email or text alone, right? There's other ways in which we can truly gauge how people are feeling. Whether that's post-event, whether that's, you know, mid-season, how are we engaging and are we finding different ways to do that? So I guess if I had to summarize, offering multiple ways in which to engage, offering visual and other ways, and also offering asynchronous events or other events that doesn't necessarily have to be whatever the dominant or where your biggest bang came from in terms of a donor engagement. And then are we looking at the language we use and the way that it's being communicated? Can we tell our stories in other ways? And are we respecting communication styles? And really, again, that last bit is reframing our feedback loops. So I don't know if that helps, but that's sort of just where I keep coming on.
Absolutely. And I feel like a lot of it comes back to where we started, is having diversity within who our employees are. And if we all look the same, as you were saying before, then these are going to be huge gaps in our understanding. Also, you know, not being afraid to talk to your donors and having those conversations. And I think you said this already as well, normalizing it. And we are fortunate that we are in a space where we are able to, in a lot of places, talk about this and be more open to that diversity. And in the spaces are slightly safer than they have been in the past. And we just have that greater awareness. Yeah. But I do love that the changing the expectations of that donor engagement and how to relate with them. I know that, you know, in a lot of the email systems, we have to have unsubscribe. And now they've changed it where we can, depending on the frequency or what we want to get, we can manage that ourselves, right? You know, I know some organizations around Mother's Day and Father's Day, they'll send out an email or a phone call and say, hey, we have this campaign going. I understand it might be sensitive for you. Do you want to be removed just for this particular campaign? And there's other times of the year, I'm sure, as well. But I think including that in your approach and not thinking, mm-hmm. oh, they don't want to be engaged in part of our community anymore. And through this process, you're likely building stronger relationships with your donors and creating that stronger community, which means you're going to have longer term donors and greater retention. I think getting close to time.
Yeah.
I want to be mindful of that. Is there any takeaways that, you know, any last?
Ooh. I think when it comes to inclusion, is not to rest on just doing one or two things, which are probably awesome, but always reevaluating, always checking in, right? And making sure that just because that's the way we've done it is continue. And I think the other thing too that I'm seeing a trend, especially within our industry, is this, again, circling back to truth and reconciliation, is we've tended to tokenize not just Indigenous, but anyone who is the beneficiary or the one who is on the receiving end of the work that we do, and that we bring respect back to the work, right? And if I can just leave on a quick story, I worked for many years with, now they're now defunct, but you might know the story of the Kilburgers and you know, yeah, Free the Children, Me to We. And I took part in many of the We days over the years. When we were in Toronto, we used to run these, I'll never forget this. Every year we would rent out the Ripley's Aquarium, the entire thing for our high-end donors, where they can come in, mingle, have food, and meet some of the folks. And we would fly in. I forget her name now, but she was a principal at one of these schools in Kenya. And she brought in two of the schoolgirls. And basically, they were there for a photo shoot. And throughout the entire time. Of course, there's wine and alcohol being poured and a typical black tie affair. And everyone had to come to get their picture taken with this mama, one of the principal. And of course, they were in their traditional Kenyan gear. And not one person engaged with that, with those individuals. And as a nonprofit, one of our failures was we had really put on a pedestal these individuals to help tell the story, but we didn't truly connect to the impact it was going to have. This was just an opportunity for a photo shoot or to get your picture taken with somebody in costume. And unfortunately, I see this still today. And even here, I'm based in the Okanagan, I see this all the time, and where we don't honor and respect. And that would probably be something, again, when we think about inclusion, is also make sure that we are including in a respectful way the individuals that we were, you know, impacting, and not just to put them on a pet. And so I share that because I think if we changed our mindset to do that, then we would be more open with the right mindset to set the table for inclusion for all our employees, for everyone who works for us, and, you know, for the donors that we work with. Because I think if we shifted our mind to think differently, then we'd be more open to this conversation around inclusion.
That's a really stark example. It's sad to hear that you're still seeing a lot of it. And I mean, I do as well. I do like to think that we are shifting and taking that more trauma-informed ethical storytelling.
Yeah.
We did a podcast a little while back. Take a listen. I'll link it in the show notes with one of our writers and Allison Roll, who has doing quite a bit of work in this area as well. But having that conversation around the ethical storytelling, which one would hope would also cascade into how we approach everything. Right. And these are, we're talking about people.
Yeah.
And I know we need to tell these impactful stories, but there are ways of doing it that also, you know, keeps that person safe in their experience as well.
Yeah.
That's a really powerful story, Mateo. Thank you. I just want to thank you so much for joining me today and sharing your insight and your stories. It's just absolutely a privilege to have you on the podcast, and love to have you on again.
Always love. I thank you so much. This is awesome.
For those listening and want to learn more about your work or invite you to speak, or how can they reach you?
They can find me on LinkedIn.
Excellent. And I'll link that in our show notes as well. So thank you so much. And if you want to reach me, I'm also on LinkedIn, or you can visit our website at associate.com/solutions/Vontier. If this conversation has sparked any ideas or inspired you to deepen belonging and inclusivity in your practice, we'd love to help. At Frontier, we work every day with fundraisers and charities to build strategies, campaigns, and connections that bring and create lasting impact. So if you're ready to do good, only better, visit our website or drop us a line. And let's build a future where belonging is a cornerstone of fundraising together. Thank you.